Good evening. This is Milton Rosenberg. Welcome again to Extension 720. It's a world full of variation. There's much that you can't depend upon. But one thing we can surely depend upon, because it's been there as long as our world has been there, and indeed longer, is simply the sun, the source of energy and the great and constant companion in our vast journey across metaphysical space and time. The sun is the constant in the life of the Earth and in the life of its later evolved species, including Homo sapiens. However, it turns out that the sun is not quite all that trustworthy, nor is it all that stable. It has made great trouble for us in the past. It may ultimately make even more trouble in coming years that will dawn rather soon. I'm basing all of this upon what I've been reading in a rather frightening but truly fascinating book by Lawrence Joseph. It's titled Solar Cataclysm, How the Sun Shaped the Past and What We Can Do to Save Our Future. And, of course, as you have anticipated, Lawrence Joseph is our guest tonight. We start the conversation right after the update on this evening's news.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg from the Allstate Studios in Chicago on 720 WGN.
And to the Allstate Studios and via telephone hookup, we welcome Lawrence Joseph, an eminent science writer with many earlier books to his credit, and now the new one, Solar Cataclysm. Lawrence Joseph, good evening.
Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I start with a little riddle or at least a little puzzle for you. What's the difference? What's the outstanding difference between you and George Harrison, late of the Beatles?
He's a global icon of an estimable value to the culture.
He is that, but also you and he have different attitudes towards the sun. You're worried about the sun. Quite worried about the sun, and that's what this book is about. Though also, of course, you're quite fascinated by the way in which the sun and alterations in its steady state, as it grows unsteady, how those alterations have affected human history and even individual human psyches. Here's George Harrison's attitude towards the sun. You know this famous song. I'm going to play the whole thing, 3 minutes. It's a great tune, worth hearing again.
Sun, I say, it's all right. Little darling, it's been a long, cold, lonely winter. Little darling, it feels like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun.
Well, and back to Lawrence Joseph. My apologies. That was taken off YouTube, I gather, and the lyric is barely discernible, but you remember it. He says, here comes the sun, things are all right, here comes the sun, little darling. The whole view is we can sustain ourselves even in times of trouble because we are always somehow illuminated by and elevated by the warming, solacing presence of the sun.
Well, you know, I've never had a more beautiful introduction to an interview, so I thank you for that.
And I'm sorry the lyric wasn't as more discernible, but still.
No, it came through this end, and I'd like to say that I don't disagree with George Harrison. I'm focusing on the darker corollary of what he says. I mean, the sun is coming. It comes every day, and every now and then it comes in storms and blasts.
The great philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein said the expectation that the sun will rise tomorrow is an hypothesis.
It's a pretty darn good one. It's the best one we know.
Yes.
The expectation that the sun will rise tomorrow and be exactly as strong and as steady as it was the day before is not such a good hypothesis, or at least not nearly as good as we had come to assume.
Yes, well, reading your book, Solar Cataclysm, has, of course, informed me of a great deal that I did not know. I don't particularly know anything about solar physics, and I've learned a great deal. But I've learned also that the sun is rather spasmodic or rather petulant or otherwise rather undependable in terms of its moods. Indeed, the mood of the sun has great consequence for what happens on the Earth, obviously.
Yeah, and what I call the moody sun hypothesis, we look at the various ups and downs in the sun's behavior, which we can chart pretty well since the end of the last ice age, which was about 12,000 years ago. And what prompted me to write this book was a day or more spent just staring at a graph of the sun's activity, which sounds pretty dull, and in fact it was. I had to remove it from my sight because I couldn't stop looking at it because I knew that there was something in there that was important, but for the life of me, I couldn't figure it out. But without describing the graph in too much detail, right after the last ice age melted, actually during its decline and return to warmer weather, the sun was at incredibly high levels of activity.
Now, what do we mean by solar activity? The sun is burning. It will burn for many, many millions of additional years. Ultimately, it will burn out, we know. But apart from its constant eating up of itself, so to speak, that is getting rid of all of its energy ultimately, in what way is the sun variable?
Well, the storms on the sun called sunspots are the best indicator that we know of the sun's variability. The more spots there are, the more explosions that emanate from those spots, some of which hit the Earth. But basically, the more sunspots that model the sun's face, the more active it is, and the more dangerous it is to the immediate solar system environment.
Now, so the surface of the sun isn't of uniform texture forever. Rather, there are eruptions, and we call them storms. What's the nature of the storm? How does the storm happen in terms of its physics?
Basically, it's a black magnetic hole, not a black hole in the cosmic sense that we've come to think of, but there's a fissure that forms because the magnetic lines of force that emanate from the center of the sun twist and break through the surface. So actually the sunspot is like a dark blemish. And frequently these fissures, for want of a better word, belch out plasma. Plasma is energy in gaseous form.
Mm-hmm.
And it can go in any direction, but those sunspots that are in the northwest quadrant of the sun's face tend to belch out these plasma storms in our direction.
And how far out do those belches go?
Well, they start out pretty compact, but by the time they travel the 93 million miles between the sun and Earth and reach us, they are in volume several times larger than the Earth.
And every time the sun belches, the belch ultimately reaches the Earth, does it? Quadrant, at least.
Yeah, from that quadrant, it's the likeliest. I mean, and, you know, sometimes we're hit with a glancing blow. Sometimes we're hit with a real full-on one. It's just kind of the luck of the draw. But over the last 12,000 years, anywhere we've been able to measure, we've been hit by a number of them, and mostly they don't do any harm. Mostly, in fact, we don't really know what ongoing role they play in sustaining our environment, but it's quite likely that these infusions of energy, not necessarily regular, but certainly intermittent over a long term, are to play some sort of helpful, sustaining role.
Now, are these what are labeled coronal mass ejections, CME?
That's correct. The sunspot is the storm on the sun. It belches a coronal mass ejection, which I've never liked that term because it's highly technical without being particularly descriptive. I'd rather just call it a plasma blob because it's really a lot more like that. It just is.
And there are some particular occasions when a major event of that sort occurred. You make a good deal in the book of an incident I knew nothing of, but apparently it's been quite well studied and documented. It's called the Carrington event of 1859. What was that?
The Carrington event of 1859 was the largest coronal mass ejection, or plasma blob, as you would, recorded to have hit the Earth. And I say recorded because there may well have been much larger that went unnoticed scientifically prior to then. And it was actually it got hit twice in the space of several days, end of August and beginning of September, 1859. And back then, it mostly was an awesome event rather than a dangerous one. The auroras danced down to the equator. Campers in the Rockies at midnight could read a book by the light of the impact. There were some problems, though, that really indicate what could happen to us today. The telegraph system, which was the only form of global communication that was electrically wired, suffered wildly. So some of the offices burned down. Some of the operators were destroyed with this tremendous sudden input of electromagnetic energy from the air, basically. It was wild, but it wasn't dangerous because back then there was nothing really. Society was not electrified, and there was no electrical installations or power grid to destroy. And I'm not sure we have time in this segment of the show, but I'd certainly like to talk about.
You've got a good sense of the flow of not only of solar mass, but of radio time. Yes, we're overdue for some commercials, but let's come directly back to what would happen if a Carrington-like event occurred tomorrow or occurred this week upon the Earth. We return directly to Lawrence Joseph, drawing from his very interesting new book, Solar Cataclysm. First, we pause for this.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And directly back to Lawrence Joseph, who's talking to us on a phone hookup from Los Angeles. We are drawing from his recently published book, Solar Cataclysm, subtitle, How the Sun Shaped the Past and What We Can Do to Save Our Future. And you are suggesting that a Carrington-like event can occur in our time. Indeed, there are indications that the sun is getting ready for some such eruption, and it will significantly disrupt our lives. By the way, who's the Carrington for whom the original event is named?
Lord Richard Carrington, the amateur astronomer, British astronomer, who observed and observed the event and traced the sunspots that gave it rise.
So what's the evidence that the sun is, in essence, getting ready for another such event?
Well, we know, I mean, there was the event of 1859 and then another one in 1921 that was almost as large. So we know that it was not a one-off event. These events occur during the solar climax, and that's the sunspots go in 11-year cycles, roughly, from maximum to maximum, minimum to minimum. And we are now entering the latest solar maximum. So if any such event is going to occur, it's going to occur between late 2012 and early 2013 is the next red zone.
Gee, that sounds like tomorrow virtually, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very close. Moreover, the cycle that we are in now bears a remarkable resemblance to the one that gave rise to the 1859 blast. It just the buildup has been slow and steady. There was an unexpected, obviously the 1859 one was not expected because we weren't tracking these things then, but it was inordinate to its immediate predecessor sunspots and blasts. So,
well, how was the blast experienced in 1859 to begin with?
Well, as I said, the telegraph system was disrupted. The fires started in the offices. Some of the operators unplugged their telegraphs and it still worked because there was so much ambient electricity in the air.
Was it felt directly in human sensation? Like a blast hitting you in the face?
No. And it wouldn't be... We wouldn't feel it at all.
But our machines would, so to speak.
Yes. Our power grid is so vulnerable to a blast of the magnitude of the Carrington event of 1859, or even the blast of 1921, that it would likely go down. And this is not just according to me. This is according to a landmark study published by the National Academy of Sciences in collaboration with NASA.
Yeah, you reproduce a good deal of that in the book Solar Cataclysm.
Yes. It's really important because this is not just Larry Joseph has decided to issue a warning. According to the National Academy of Sciences report, severe space weather, up to 130 million Americans could be without electricity for months or years.
Good Lord.
If a Carrington-sized event were to hit us today. Now, this is...
That's Americans, but it will affect all the world, I presume.
Yes, of course... Well, what happens is the closer you are to the pole, so the closer your industrial base, a country's industrial base is to the North Pole or the South Pole, the more vulnerable the infrastructure is. Because the magnetic field is weakest at the poles. I don't know if you remember from, you know, how magnetic fields sort of emanate from the poles and then...
So this would hurt Canada and Tierra del Fuego down in Argentina even more than us.
Yes. In the United States, the Northeast, Midwest, and Northwest would be likely be most affected.
Yeah. But yes, affected by knocking out the power grid and electricity is lost. That means virtually all communication systems, doesn't it?
Well, it means little or no telecom, but not just that. It means little or no water or gasoline because the pumps are electric.
Uh-huh.
It means little or no refrigeration for food and medicine. Little or no... law enforcement, military security, banking, or emergency services.
Well, that means total social chaos and breakdown, doesn't it?
It really does. And we are so... Electricity is the cornerstone technology of this society.
Surely,
we have no idea what it would be like. People say, well, it would be like living in a pre-electric age. I say, no. Be much worse than that, because those folks knew how to live without electricity, because they had never grown dependent upon it. What we face today is a paradox of progress. The more advanced we become in our technology and our sophisticated lifestyle, the more dependent we become on that technology.
Does this also knock out something as simple as television and the Internet and everything else that we depend upon for both entertainment and communication?
If you have to plug it in, it ain't going to work.
Exactly so.
And this has been taken remarkably seriously. Again, it's the National Academy of Sciences, which was founded during Abraham Lincoln's day, by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War. It's the most august group of American scientists that we know of. And it's been taken to heart. I attended a 19-nation summit conference at Parliament in London, where all of us were forced to sign a pledge at the workshop the next day not to discuss what went on there. Really tough for a writer, but I can say two things. One, pray. And two, a year later, the United Kingdom came out with a comprehensive plan to protect our grid.
Well, now look, what's the relevant scientific community that really is plugged in on these matters, that understands this stuff? And to what degree is there consensus within that scientific community that this is a looming threat that is bound to come down upon us?
Well, Solar physics is the general realm, and then specifically, you need electrical engineers to study the impact on the grid. And we've had lots of it's become very political about that, because essentially there is a solution, and that makes things difficult. Because if I were just warning doom here, and we could shrug our shoulders and, you know, just cross our fingers and go on to the next topic.
Or pray.
Yes, or pray, absolutely. But there's a way to protect our grid. And it's simple. I never thought my career as a writer would add up to surge suppressors. It just doesn't have that pizzazz.
There is a way, then, to defend against the dire effects of such an eruption if it happened.
Absolutely.
And that will be revealed. I'm going to play the radio game. That will be revealed by our guest, Lawrence Joseph, author of Solar Cataclysm, directly after we pause for the usual update on the evening's news.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And right back to Lawrence E. Joseph, author of Solar Cataclysm, that book only recently published by Harper One. Now, Lawrence, just to quickly summarize or to bring this to a head before we come to the solution that you've got available, something equivalent to the Carrington event of 1859 were to occur, as you say, predictions suggest it will occur shortly, perhaps even before the end of this year and or on into next year. Let us call that the Joseph event of 2012-2013. You say that would knock out the power grid, many power grids around the world, and essentially plunge those societies into darkness, into the absence of power to sustain all their communication systems and all of their maintenance systems. Anything that you need to plug in would no longer be working. Possibly that could be the case for months and maybe even a year or more to follow, which would obviously produce absolute social chaos and regress us to very low levels of competitiveness and ultimately, I should think, of murderousness. But how likely is that? If I were to do the following, if I were to use my academic connections here in Chicago and go to the solar physicists in the physics department at the University of Chicago, where I've worked for many years, and go up to Northwestern to the engineering school and round up a bunch of electrical engineers, suppose I had 20 or 30 such technically proficient people in a room and played for them what we've said so far, would they agree that this is an imminent danger?
It's difficult to say because I've found a wide variety of responses. I mean, there's beyond professional expertise. There's a limit to what people can, the calamity that people can and are willing to imagine. If I were a part of that discourse, I think it would be helpful because I would say, well, for example, in 1989, are you familiar with the solar blast that knocked out the power to Hydro-Quebec for several million people for 9 hours, and some of whom were without power for weeks, and also knocked out a nuclear plant in New Jersey without incident, thank goodness. Or are you familiar with the 2003 Halloween storm that knocked out 14 transformers and crippled South Africa's electrical infrastructure for years? I don't take it just because they're academically credentialed that they are necessarily aware.
But there are some academically credentialed persons who are aware and are warning about this impending danger, are they?
Absolutely. And as I said, it's not just me. It's the National Academy of Sciences.
Right. Well, that's important. So you said there is a solution, and it's a rather feasible and not a terribly costly one. What indeed is it?
Well, it's as I mentioned, it's surge suppressors. It's just the way that you plug your flat-screen TV into a surge suppressor or your computer or other fine electronic equipment to protect against surges in the local electricity, as do happen from time to time. We need to protect the power grid by placing surge suppressors around the key nodal points, which are called transformers.
Now, how does a surge suppressor work?
Surge suppressor basically shunts any extra incoming electricity off to a neutral or a ground.
Uh-huh.
So basically, here's what would happen in the case of a Carrington event hitting today. It would the blast would hit. Normally, the blast would be channeled safely by the Earth's magnetic field, but every now and then the blast is big enough to crash through. So the 1859 event certainly did crash through the Earth's protective magnetic field. The electromagnetic radiation goes into the ground, then pops back up, a little bit of it. Not much, but a little bit of it. We would not be physically harmed in any way. It's not like we'd all be shocked. But the tolerances of the large transformers that hold the grid together are so fine that even just a few volts of electrical current can render them useless. And I don't mean just break them. These things, the biggest ones, which are over 100 tons, have find their copper windings fused solid. So you can't just send out a utility crew to fix the thing. It has to be replaced. Currently, there's a waiting list on the world market of 3 years for the largest set of transformers, none of which are made anymore in the United States.
I suppose they're mostly made in China, are they?
China, India, and Brazil.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, and I don't regard any of those countries necessarily as enemies, but I would not want to be at the mercy of a foreign power to help restore our electricity. I mean, you know, logic would dictate that they would demand.
But surge suppressors, if properly installed, could deflect the full effects of a of such a Carrington event, a coronal mass ejection. Where do we get these surge suppressors? What do they cost? How many do you need? What's the way in which you would array them around the country or around the world to protect us?
Excellent question. First, you protect your largest transformers. There are about 350 transformers in the North American grid that carry the heaviest voltage, 750,000 volts. And those are the ones that we need to protect because they're going down would be the most disastrous, and those are the ones that we would install surge suppressors first. It wouldn't protect the grid entirely, but it would be the difference between a significant inconvenience and a utter catastrophe. The cost is difficult to assess closely, but most estimates I've seen range between $500 million and $1.5 billion.
That's like running the United States for a day and a half, or less.
You know, it's not AIG bailout money, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And this has been taken so seriously that the United States House of Representatives voted unanimously to proceed with take the next steps towards supplying these surge suppressors and implementing them in the grid. Unanimously, those guys won't cross the aisle to perform the Heimlich maneuver, but they agreed unanimously on this. However, the bill was completely scuttled in the Senate, ostensibly because there was a jurisdictional dispute among committees as to who had power over the grid.
When did that happen?
2010.
My goodness.
Yes.
I don't think it was widely reported. I did not know about it.
No, it's. I've been trying. I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times in August 2010, encouraging the Senate to reconsider. But, you know, the Senate didn't listen to me. Big surprise. But you know, I don't care whose ear.
So nothing's happening along those lines at the moment, is that it?
Well, you know, people are trying very hard, but it's very difficult, and it's not the money. Really, you know, in the grand scheme of things, $1 billion is well worth it to protect basic society health and welfare. It's the utility industry, the power grid is very difficult and complex to take care of and understand because there's no grid czar. There is a central authority, but it doesn't really have that much power. And the electrical power grid around the United States is this amalgam of public, private, semi-cross-border, all these different entities which operate independently. And the utility industry as a whole, understandably, bridles at the notion of what they see as an invasive regulation.
Well, this is very important stuff, and I'm very glad we were able to cover this ground tonight. Of course, it's covered far more fully in the book by Lawrence Joseph, Solar Cataclysm. And as I said earlier, the subtitle is How the Sun Shaped the Past and What We Can Do to Save Our Future. We've been talking about our future. In a few minutes before we pause for another round of commercials, let's talk about the sun, how the sun shaped our past. And I started with George Harrison. Now I give you the Old Testament, the book of Joshua, Joshua 12 and 13. Then spake Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites before the children of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. Is not this written in the book of Joshua? So the sun stood still in the midst of heaven and hasted not to go down about a whole day. Do we have any records since those days of the sun standing still, whether upon Gibeon or any place else in the world?
You know, we have no record of it, but that doesn't mean one doesn't exist, that it didn't happen. Because, you know, in a recent book I wrote a great deal about how Noah's flood, the flood that is written in Noah's Ark, and it's also written in Greek mythology and many other places, has actually been pinpointed to a specific date by scientists looking at impact craters and things of that sort, and working collaboratively around the globe. So, you know what? No, nothing that I know of would corroborate that passage from the Bible, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. We just may not have found it yet.
Where has the sun, what turns in history have been heavily influenced by changes in the behavior, so to speak, of the sun?
Well, the settling of the United States of America, or what is now the United States of America, was completely determined by that.
How so?
Well, the Vikings clearly made the voyage across to what they called Vinland, Vin meaning wine, and when they made landing in the east coast of Canada, they were very happy to find grapes growing there, and therefore they could make wine, and that was the principal export business that they seemed to be wanting to develop. But as you know, the Vikings did not end up colonizing and imparting their cultural stamp to our history because, why? Is it because they gave up and they got bored? No. It's because...
Maybe they got too drunk on the wine.
Well, those guys are pretty hardy. What happened was, it was called the medieval warm period when they were sailing.
Yeah.
The sun was particularly strong. And then the sun calmed down a bit. And the northern North Atlantic, where they sailed, became choked with ice for much of the year, and it made the voyage impossible. The seas were impassable. So they could not follow through with the real colonization of the land that they found. They just couldn't get here anymore. And so that was an astonishing, it was not just a quirk of history, but it was a quirk of climate history. And we tend to think of history as done by, driven by, subject to human beings. But so much of it I've learned from writing this book is really a consequence of what the climate did.
In this same book, you seem to suggest that if global warming has occurred, it may not have anything to do with the emissions from the Earth. It may rather have to do with sunspots.
Well, I think that the best approach is to understand that both contribute to it. I went to a solar physics conference a couple of years ago where they were handing out pamphlets saying that about 30% of global warming was due to the sun's heightened activity over the last 150 years, and particularly over the last 20 or 30. And I said, my God, 30% is a significant amount. You know, I mean, why are we not hearing more about this? It's not all, it's not even most, but it's still, you know, a 30% factor is not negligible. And they said, well, they felt that the information would be misused by polluters who would want to say, hey, you know, it's all the sun's fault.
Now, Lawrence, we've got to pause. I'm late for some commercials, the last batch. But also, before that, it's time to invite telephone calls. We'll have about 10 minutes in the clear for calls. So if you want to pose a question to Lawrence Joseph, now's the time you should make your move instantly by calling us at 312-591-7200. 312-591-7200 is where you reach us. The lines await your pleasure. Also, if you are listening at some great distance over the Internet and would rather get in via email, the email address extension720@wgnradio.com. And the aforesaid phone number, 312-591-7200. I look for some good calls. Get them in right now. We'll be with you in just a few minutes.
Extension 720 with Milt Rosenberg on 720 WGN.
And we're in the clear now for a number of phone calls, and we'll go directly to the first caller, that being Tim, who joins us at WGN Radio Chicago. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi, Good evening. My question is if the Senate and the rest of the government cannot agree on how to protect the grid or whether to protect the grid, why aren't the individual companies who use the grid or the grid operators themselves supplying this these surge suppressors? $1 billion seems like a relatively modest amount in today's economy.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A well-formulated question. Lawrence Joseph.
Well, first of all, it has to be coordinated action. You could protect your own transformer, but if the transformer upstream wasn't protected, there's a problem. But the deeper problem is that the utility industry is probably behind the inaction in the Senate. Like any other industry, understandably, it guards against regulatory incursion. And the utility industry in general is a very conservative industry. It's a steady, I don't know if you remember from Monopoly, but the utility was the steady payer, the regulated rate. It's not an innovative industry. It ranks almost last among industries in percentage of income spent on research and development, even below pet foods. So it's a culture that is very difficult to move, not only attitudinally but legally, because, as I said, utilities are public-private partnerships. Some are not-for-profit, some are profit, some are cross-border. It's just a thicket that doesn't want to give way.
Our thanks to Tim for a useful question indeed, and we'll go directly to the next caller, that being Dave. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. I'm not an electrician or nobody. I just own a flat screen with a surge suppressor. But I know the power is directed through the surge suppressor to the TV. If there's a solar flare, isn't that going to go all around through the transformer and everything? How do you direct that surge through the surge suppressor? How does it get directed right through the surge suppressor to the transformer if the flare-up is all around?
What you do is you place the surge suppressor between the ground. Remember, the electricity is going to come in from the atmosphere, hit the ground, then pop back up. It's the pop back up electricity that's the most dangerous right here to us right here. So you place the surge suppressor between the transformer and the ground, and the literal physical earth ground, and that should intercept most of it.
All right, thank you. That's what I didn't understand. Thank you.
We thank you, sir, for the call. 312-591-7200 is the number. Now, there are one or two lines available. If you've been trying to reach us and getting the busy signal, make another quick try. Obviously, somebody will get through at 312-591-7200. And Bill is next. Good evening, sir. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Bill, and my question is this. If an individual has solar panels on their home, would they be affected by this, or would they be free and still be able to get get their energy?
It's a good question. I think the answer is that you're likely a lot better off if you're off-grid or if you can switch to an off-grid power supply such as solar. But the inverters, which basically do the converting from the solar to the electricity, are vulnerable to CME assault. So if you got solar panels, make sure your inverter is what they call hardened or kept in a sheathed in a protective metal cage. That should do the trick, knock wood.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you for the information.
Well, thank you, sir, for the call. A moment out, that is a moment away from the phone calls. There's a good deal in this interesting book of yours, Solar Cataclysm, about our long relationship with the sun. Of course, the sun is 4.5 billion, billion with a B, years old, but it's only one of billions and billions of other suns, literally in our galaxy. And in our we estimate 100 billion suns in our galaxy, the Milky Way. And there are, by estimation, 100 billion other galaxies in the known universe, all with essentially equal numbers, or rather, on average, about 100 billion suns per galaxy. It can run as up as 500 million, as low as perhaps 50 billion. But there's a lot of sun around, but we've only got one, and we know that it will not last forever. What are the current estimates about when and how our sun burns out?
Oh, we're doing pretty good.
It's not going to happen tomorrow.
No, I think we've got about 5.5 to 6 billion years is the current estimates I've seen. I mean, before then, though, I mean, maybe a billion years shy of that, the sun will become unmanageable from our point of view. It will change, the changes in it will be murderous to life on Earth as we know it at this point.
It will become a red giant in the sky, won't it?
Yeah. And, you know, it will expand part or all the way to us, which could be quite inconvenient and awfully toasty.
By that time, or a million years before that, or a billion years before that, we ought to get off this planet and settle elsewhere.
Yeah, but you know what? We've got a couple billion years of human evolution to figure that out, and
yes,
we'll let those folks take care of it.
We won't exist as the present species that we are, at any rate. Quickly,
probably
back
not
to the phones, and our next caller is Rick. Good evening, sir. You're on the air, but rather briefly, I fear, just a minute or two.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. We do get some notice when this would happen. Could they not just shut down the whole power system to save it from being wiped out?
Absolutely. There, depending on how heavy an assault is going to be and where it's going to hit, we can they can shunt power loads. They can isolate certain areas that they think are vulnerable from other areas. There's a lot that can be done. There's a satellite called ACE about a million miles out that kind of sits in a gravity hole that is our best first warning for this sort of thing. Unfortunately, its batteries are running out, and there's been no funding for its replacement.
So we've been short-sighted in many ways.
Yet again.
Yet again. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Well, we have just about a minute left. What important aspect of this whole inquiry that you've got in solar cataclysm have we not touched upon that you want to spend the last minute upon?
I just want folks to use their imaginations about the sun, because I think I've just scratched the surface, and, you know, with my poor power to add and detract, maybe I have come up with some things. But, you know, the sun heals us. The sun makes us ill. The sun empowers our planet, and the sun imperils our planet. It's just, think of those four aspects: health, ill, power, danger, and you will likely come up with something. Folks listening will likely come up with many other ways that we could look at the sun. I think we're just at the very, very beginning of this line of inquiry, and I encourage anybody who's got some curiosity and creativity to mull it all over.
And an excellent entry into that line of inquiry is, of course, to read the new book by Lawrence Joseph, who also, I should have added, Lawrence, you do write with great vigor and color. And the book, the title of that book, Solar Cataclysm. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure entirely. Thank you.
And a quick word in half a minute about tomorrow. Tomorrow, of course, is the presidential debate. The station will carry it at 8 o'clock. You'll hear the full debate here. And as we're told, it will end around 9:30, and then I will be back on the air for a longer than usual version of Extension 720 from 9:30 till midnight with three guests, excellent guests. I don't have time to identify them, but we will also field your reactions to the debate as you have listened to it, and we'll see where we stand in the presidential race about 24 hours from this moment. Until tomorrow at 9:30 after the debate, thanks to all for listening, and a most cordial good night.